Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The gate to the kingdom is opening once more. This month sees the return of Lars von Trier's cult 90s series The Kingdom. The acclaimed filmmaker behind Antichrist, Melancholia and Nymphomaniac is picking up where he left off with The Kingdom Exodus, a brand new limited series available exclusively on Mubi from November 27th. A continuation, reboot and revival of the original series, The Kingdom Exodus is a disturbing, darkly funny blend of supernatural ghost story and workplace sitcom, with von Trier's signature anarchic streak once again at the fore. If you're new to The Kingdom, Mubi has you covered. Newly restored versions of The Kingdom 1 and 2 are streaming on the platform from November 13th and 20th. Episode 1 of The Kingdom Exodus is released a week later on November 27th, with new episodes dropping weekly on Mubi right up until December 25th. Consider it an early gift from your friend and ours, Lars von Trier. Head to Mubi.com to start streaming. Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Adam Woodward.
And I'm Karis Aldridge.
On the show this week, a pair of young cannibals go on an unforgettable road trip in Bones and All. Rian Johnson and Benoit Blanc return with Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery. And I spoke to its stars Catherine Hahn and Kate Hudson about their roles in the delightful new murder mystery. And on Film Club, it's Lars von Trier's cult classic, The Kingdom. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, Karis, very excited to have you on the podcast for the first time. For listeners who are unaware, could you explain who you are and what you do?
Yeah, of course. So, thank you so much for inviting me on. I've been a very loyal listener and I love the podcast. So, yes, in my kind of day to day, I am an executive working in independent film sales and distribution. And I also host my own podcast called The Uncertainties, which is kind of interviewing very interesting people from all walks of life and kind of talking to them about the things that make them the most uncertain or have made them the most uncertain in their 20s and how they've been able to navigate that.
I mean, I've just so much admiration for you guys. When I was in my 20s, I was an absolute mess. Any kind of podcast I would have contributed would have just been like, I don't know, I could barely get up in the morning. So like, you doing it, that suggests to me that you've actually got it more together than most.
Oh, I'm not sure. I mean, that's kind of the aim of the podcast. That is, I hope that it's quite relatable and that people do feel like they're kind of stumbling through that decade. So yeah, I hope I'm not alone in that feeling.
When it comes to films, are there anything that you kind of in your 20s have like returned to and you feel like good guides for, you know, kind of getting everything together or just kind of things that were big milestones for you to watch?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think off the top of my head, something like 500 Days of Summer is something that it's a film that I love that I've kind of come back to. I think it's a great kind of exploration of relationships at that time. And it's one that I remember watching years ago and thinking, oh, I hate that character. I hate this character. And I always kind of, as I grow and mature, have become more empathetic to different perspectives. So I think in terms of that first big relationship, which I think quite a few people do have in their 20s, that can be quite a relatable film that's quite good to return to.
Adam, what about you? Anything that kind of formed your soul in your 20s that you watched?
I'm trying to think. I mean, you know, I was already kind of working at Little White Lies in sort of my early 20s. So I'm trying to think what the kind of big films that I sort of first watched in a kind of professional capacity, I suppose. I almost see it as like there was a bit of a shift from just kind of watching films as a kind of, you know, general Joe Public movie watcher, and then now kind of doing it in a more professional capacity. So I don't know. I remember I went to very early press screening of Martin Scorsese's Shutter Island, and that being like quite a big thing because he was someone obviously whose films I really loved and had very much been like a guide for me, I think, through my sort of early ventures into cinephilia. And I remember really not liking it and being like, oh, this is interesting. I think that's maybe not a great example to give for like a guide film, but I remember that experience a lot, and then remember obviously like revisiting a lot of his films around that time and trying to sort of like get more of a kind of grounding in the professional world of film criticism, which was, you know, I had massive like imposter syndrome at the time and very much felt like I was playing catch up with a lot of people. So I think I just kind of watched as much as I could around that time.
There's something like weirdly reassuring to imposter syndrome, though, when you think of Martin Scorsese being able to make a film that's not that great.
Oh, yeah. And I stand by that. I mean, I've since rewatched Shutter Island and still think it's very much like low tier Scorsese. But there you go.
Yeah, I mean, Martin Scorsese is someone that the internet seems to keep coming for at the moment, and I really wish that they would leave him alone because, you know, he's wonderful, and particularly what he does for world cinema. And I think that's what really happened to me in my 20s. I started watching Usman Sambeh, and I started getting into Korean cinema and stuff, and, you know, kind of a feeling that, like, this was maybe like a path to understanding something wider about the world. And that's still, I suppose, where my interests lie.
I would just add quickly that Karis's podcast is really great and everyone should listen to it.
Thank you. It's very very kind.
It's true. But we should move on to some of the films that we're covering this week. It's a pretty solid selection. I mean, looking forward, there's not going to be many episodes like this in the coming months, but we are on a bit of a winning streak at the moment. So we'll start first with Luca Guadagnino's Bones and All. Bones and All is a story of first love between Marin, a young cannibal learning how to survive on the margins of society. She meets fellow eater Lee, an intense and disenfranchised grifter, and they join together for a thousand-mile odyssey which takes them through the backroads, hidden passages, and trapdoors of Ronald Reagan's America. So, Karis, like, coming into this, were you what they refer to as a shallomaniac, or were you what we have coined on this podcast as a shallonaysayer? What was your feelings about coming to a Timothée Chalamet film?
You know, I'm probably in the camp of shallomaniac. Am I saying that correctly? Maybe not too obsessive, but I'm definitely a big fan of Timothée Chalamet. Every time I want to say his surname, I say Shalamala Bing Bong because I have that interview with Florence Pugh, and I'm like, nope, that's not his name. But I truly loved this movie. I was very trepidatious going into it, just because if someone says kind of cannibalism and horror in the same sentence, I'm always a little bit like, ooh. But I was so pleasantly surprised, and yeah, I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, it's a lot sadder than it is scary, I would say.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't even know that I'd categorise this as a horror film, would you?
No, that's the thing. I think it's interesting when you read reviews online that do categorise it as a horror, and I think it says something about the filmmaking that it transcends that genre. I mean, a friend of mine who I was watching it with kind of turned to me at the end and said that felt very Shakespearean, kind of like Romeo and Juliet, and I was like, you know what, it does. I think there's so much more to it and lots of layered meanings, and you know, I think I mostly interpreted it as more of a kind of a teenage love story and an exploration of kind of abandonment and grief and family secrets. So yeah, I don't really think of it as a horror at all.
Yeah, I remember coming out of this screening a couple of months ago, and you know, I had to put on my sunglasses in the screening because I was very embarrassed by how much I was weeping, and I had to sort of almost be like, you know, almost like somebody in a James Brown concert. I had to be huddled away by some friends because I was like near collapse. I was so moved by it all. Adam, did you have like a similar feeling? Were you sort of caught up in the romance and the devastation of it all?
Yeah, I think it definitely works best as a romance, as a teenage romance. And I think the scenes where Timothy and Taylor Russell are on screen together are probably the strongest. And that is like a good chunk of the runtime as well. I must say, I really love the opening. It sort of has this quite cold open with Taylor Russell and her father, and there's this sort of sense that they live this quite transient existence, and there's quite a kind of gruesome scene early on at a sleepover, which kind of sets the tone for what's to follow. And this almost like discovery, it's this kind of double-edged thing, right, of her coming of age, and also her kind of like, I guess it's like sexual awakening as well, is wrapped up in there, but her awakening to her bloodlust. Yeah, I think it's like a pretty solid film. I must say, Luca is a director who kind of baffles me a little bit. I think going back to his early career and certainly earlier sort of English language career, going from stuff like I Am Love and Call Me By Your Name to like Suspiria and then this, he's gone down this very, very interesting route, making these kind of now this sort of like YA romance. And I sort of wish he'd get back to making more like adult films a little bit, not to sort of damn this one with faint praise too much, but for me it was like it works on a certain level, but I don't think there's all that much going on kind of beneath the surface. I know the background context of like Reagan's America is there, but for me it's the same thing with like Suspiria didn't really have much to say about the Holocaust or Holocaust survival, and that seemed to be a sort of line that people went with quite a lot. And I think the same with this. I'm not sure this really has much to say about Reaganism or the kind of wider socio-political context, but as a sort of road movie, as a romance, it's quite fun. It's got some good performances. I really like Taylor Russell. I hadn't really seen her in much before, and I think she's really strong, and Timothy doing good work as ever. And, you know, there's some fun, kind of gruesome stuff. Although I think you're right in saying, Karis, it's not really a horror film. There is still some quite nice, let's say, kind of squelchy, gory sound effects and, you know, stuff that does make you want to look away from the screen a little bit. So, yeah, I think it's got a little bit of everything in it.
Oh, I feel much more warmly about it than you do. But, Karis, like, beyond the kind of level of, like, beautiful cannibals falling in love, there's been kind of talk of like, you know, what does this say about Reagan's America? Is this a queer love story? Is this kind of all about outsider art? Like, did you kind of see a sort of metatextual layer to it?
Absolutely. I think for me, once I'd had a few days to kind of ruminate, I really appreciated the film even more than I did whilst watching it. I see where you're coming from, Adam, and that like, it is interesting. You know, I think it is very deliberate to set it in that kind of post-Reagan era and that kind of idea of that loss of innocence that is very kind of prevalent in the movie. But I do kind of see that it does take a little bit of work from the audience to be putting those bits together. It's not necessarily kind of screaming from the screen. But yeah, I absolutely think that there is a lot of layered meaning in this. I know I was very lucky to see Luca afterwards discussing the movie, and he was kind of talking about how he surprised himself in it being a very deeply personal film in the end, because he lost his father the previous year. And I think something that is at the core of this film, as I mentioned earlier, is the topic of grief. And I think that's incredibly important, and that idea of abandonment and that feeling of, yeah, these disenfranchised youths that are on the fringes of society. And I know that's something that he says is a theme that he seems to kind of keep returning to in not just this movie, but previous films as well. So I definitely got quite a lot out of it. And I think it's one that you can think about for a long time afterwards. But yeah, I agree that maybe it maybe is asking quite a lot of the audience to maybe put those bits together instead of it being very kind of apparent.
Yeah, the parent, the sort of absent parent aspect of the story is interesting. And I think maybe this is just because I really love Andre Holland as an actor, but I kind of wanted a little bit more of him. And you understand why he kind of has to leave or depart the film as early as he does, although he kind of reappears as in kind of like voiceover occasionally. But the film then becomes much more focused on Taylor Russell's character's relationship with her mother and her sort of tracking down her mother. And for me, that was like maybe the weakest element of the film, as much as it kind of is this like cathartic moment for her and quite a kind of horrific moment when it happens. Maybe that's the closest the film does stray into kind of traditional horror, actually. But yeah, I thought that kind of was not quite handled as well, whereas I felt much more the connection there, obviously, between Taylor Russell and Andre Holland. And that relationship, I thought, was much more interesting. Like, you've raised a child who has this condition, let's say. How, you know, how do you respond to that? What does that actually look like? You don't obviously get much of that in the film for obvious reasons, but that was, I think, the bit I was more interested in than the sort of like her trying to track down her mother and, I suppose, answer questions about her own humanity or lack of it.
When it came to the kind of technical side of things, I mean, he's clearly referencing Terrence Malick with a lot of these shots. Do you think he was sort of able to reach those heights, or do you think that is a sort of too high a bar for Luca to set himself?
I mean, it's a very pretty looking film. There is a sort of, bit of a sort of Badlands vibe, I suppose, to this in certain scenery and imagery. But, you know, it's certainly not the first contemporary film to have kind of been tipping its hat to Malick in that way. And you know, I think certainly if someone who is a bit more familiar with the American Midwest and that whole expanse of land would probably appreciate it on that level. But no, I'm not sure it could quite hold a candle up to Malick. But it's doing its own thing, I think, as well. Like, I certainly don't think, as much as I didn't fully connect with it, I'm not sure, I don't think this is like a derivative film. And actually, it must be said, it's really hard to do something new with the genre or the kind of the subject of cannibalism or vampires or this, you know, we're in this territory of like elevated horror, to use air quotes now. But obviously these stories have always had a kind of allegorical edge to them since the very beginning, right? So I think nowadays it's quite hard to do something really kind of fully new with this. And actually, to his credit, and I know it's based on a source novel, but the way it's been adapted, I think, is interesting, and it's certainly trying to do its own thing. So I think, yeah, definitely kind of commend it for that.
And Karis, I wanted to ask you about what you thought of Mark Rylance, because he was sort of originally considered a sort of do no wrong actor, and then he's made some kind of wild choices in the past couple of years. But like, did you see his sort of, you know, he's the antagonist Sully, I suppose, to sum up his part without giving out any spoilers. I mean, did you find him compelling as the antagonist?
I did. Yeah, I really did. You know, there's something so deeply unsettling about the way that he played that character. And you're so kind of distrusting of him and his intentions, really up until the very end. And he doesn't actually, now I think about it, get that much screen time, but I think he does a lot with that role in the time that he does get. I found Sully to be a very fascinating, but yeah, as I say, unsettling character. And yeah, I think there are some very interesting choices that he made on screen. The bit that I think was like very visceral and like deeply unsettling is that bit with Marin and Sully when he's making her food, and the kind of use of like textures and sounds that Luca uses with the, he kind of like crushes a carcass basically on the table, and it stirs something so unsettling within you. But I think it's in those choices and the way that he plays that character is, I thought, was really interesting. I kind of wanted to dive a bit more into that question, the kind of the third person disassociation of and that kind of psyche, I thought was really fascinating.
And I thought it was something that was brought out so beautifully in the costumes, because Sully does kind of have a strangely like militaristic look about him. So there's an air of a sort of traumatized Vietnam vet without us ever like specifically kind of saying that this is what this is a metaphor for. But yeah, I mean, the costumes for me is just such a highlight. To be Timothy Chalamet with that pearl twin set, I couldn't get enough of it. Adam, you have mocked me in the past for having bad taste in music and film scores, particularly that I like the Thor ones. I'm wondering, I was very moved by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross's score of this, particularly the final song. I kind of came out desperately trying to Google what this song was without realizing it had been made for the film. Am I correct in thinking that this was a great score, or have I gotten it wrong again?
No, I mean, I apologize unreservedly for mocking you in the past, but I think this is pretty good. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have that kind of like Visions of Gideon moment at the end, but it's a strong, I think, a strong score throughout. And I don't know, I'm just plucking a kind of composing double act out of the air really, but if you compare it to kind of the work that Nick Cave and Warren Ellis do, which I think more recently has become a lot more kind of schematic and much more kind of formulaic, and they have a very distinct sound. I think what Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross do consistently is like almost like reinvent the way they approach sound design and scores. I think Karis alluded to it earlier as well, but the texture of the film, like the audio texture of the film and the score, work so well in sync together. And I think they're just, yeah, really at the top of their game here.
Glad to know that I haven't embarrassed myself again. But we should get some scores on this before we move on to the next movie. Karis, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
I'm going to go 2, 4, 5 for this.
Oh, interesting. So the two you weren't looking forward to it that much, had you hated Suspiria?
Didn't love Suspiria. And I think also, as I mentioned, I think I was a bit trepidatious about the kind of horror cannibalistic elements of it. But also, I think people seem to feel very passionately about Call Me By Your Name. And I enjoyed the movie, but I don't think I loved it as much as a number of people did. So I was a bit cautious approaching this film. But I was, as I said, yeah, very pleasantly surprised, especially kind of in retrospect.
Adam, what about you?
Well, I would say I was all up for some cannibal action, so maybe a 4. I mean, I didn't really like Suspiria, but maybe a 4 in anticipation, and then probably 3 and 3, but like a very high 3 for enjoyment and in retrospect. It's probably a film I would revisit. I'm sure there's more in there that is there to discover, but yeah, didn't like fully connect with me, I'm afraid.
Well, I have done my end of years list, and this features very highly on them. So yeah, maybe a 3 in anticipation. You know, not the biggest fan of Luca, but you know, it sounded promising. YA isn't really my thing, so the first images looked very cool, and yeah, probably 4 in enjoyment and 5 in retrospect. I absolutely loved it. I can't remember the last time that I was so kind of profoundly moved and bought into a young love story so well. I think as two young actors, Taylor Russell and Timothy Chalamet, have something quite rare where you really don't see the wheels turning in their acting. So when it comes to kind of two people fall in love, it's very easy to buy into. Less Suspiria, more of this, please. Next up, Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Glass Onion is best entered into with only minimal plot in mind. Suffice to say, the upcoming plot summary, the interview, and the review will be spoiler-free. What we can tell you is that tech billionaire Miles Bronn invites his closest friend for a murder mystery party mid-pandemic. The assembled crew involve Leslie Odom Jr. as Lionel, his obedient head scientist, Catherine Hahn, an eco-warrior politician running for Senate, whose campaign is funded by Bronn. Dave Bautista plays Shock Jock Duke, a men's rights activist hoping to broadcast on a more significant platform and to finally impress his influencer girlfriend Whiskey, as well as Kate Hudson, a problematic fashionista named Birdie. The murder mystery party getaway on Glass Onion, his private Greek island, is made all the more enigmatic by the surprising accepted invitation of Janelle Monáe as his screwed-over ex-business partner and Daniel Craig's renowned detective Benoit Blanc. When somebody dies on the island, Blanc must discover who the killer is. So, Adam, you've been hard at work on the Glass Onion and Knives Out mystery issue. What was it about this film that you felt kind of warranted a whole issue devoted to it?
Yeah, well, I must say, not me personally too hard at work. My colleagues David and Hannah have definitely done the kind of bulk of the heavy lifting on this issue. But yeah, it's the current cover of Little White Lies, issue 96, I believe, out now. And I don't know, I think we're all like fans of Knives Out, fans of Rian Johnson generally, and got the opportunity to see this one nice and early and just really loved it. I mean, if listeners are already acquainted with Knives Out and that whole world, and certainly Benoit Blanc, Daniel Craig's super sleuth, this I would say is it's obviously like a new story. It's got Benoit Blanc in it as the kind of protagonist again, but it's real fun. It's a bit of a step up, I think, in terms of what Rian Johnson is doing with the genre. And I think it's just visually interesting. There's so much for us to explore in this issue as we do around, you know, murder mysteries and some of the kind of films which Rian Johnson is referencing. There's stuff like The Last of Sheila, which is a film that many people may not have seen, but it's Stephen Sondheim and Andy Perkins' sole screenwriting credit from the kind of 70s. And it's a murder mystery, but set on a yacht. And it's very much a kind of sun-soaked whodunit. So whereas, you know, the previous film Knives Out had this more kind of cozy Agatha Christie vibe, this is a bit more exotic. But I think it's much more contemporary feeling as well. Knives Out had this slight political edge. You've got characters in there who very much kind of the kind of 2019. You had a kind of alt-right troll kid in it. But this one, I think, is a lot more kind of scabrous, and Rian Johnson is very much more pointedly satirising certain figures. I mean, Miles Bronn, the character who constructs this quite literal glass onion on a remote island in Greece and invites everyone to come and play this game on the island is he's a kind of quite thinly veiled proxy for someone like Elon Musk. And it's quite fascinating now talking about the film and thinking about it again in the context of what's happening with like Twitter and everything. And there's this whole kind of running joke in the film of like, no one can quite work out whether Miles Bronn is a genius or an idiot, but so many people are kind of reliant on him and his kind of power, basically. And so the film explores this really quite fun, interesting dynamic between all the main characters. And then you enter Daniel Craig into the fray. It sort of starts off with no one really understanding why he's there. And they all just think, oh, this is fun. Miles has brought along this world-renowned detective to kind of help play the game. And it soon becomes apparent that he's not actually been invited by Miles himself. So, yeah, that's, I guess, as much as we should say about the plot. I mean, I don't know how much detail we can go into, really. But it's definitely one to just experience firsthand and maybe not know too much going in.
Yeah, I mean, I love a murder mystery. I think we've not been in a good period with murder mysteries. And a lot of the ones, particularly the Kenneth Branagh ones, they really fail because it's just sort of all set up, all red herrings, and then one big reveal. Whilst what Rian Johnson's does, which is so much more interesting, is you keep getting new twists and turns and different bits of information throughout that actually build to a conclusion, rather than a sort of Scooby-Doo ripping off of the mask and it's like, oh, this is the bad guy. Karis, for you, is this the sort of film that you like, kind of that murder mystery, comedy, satire sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I do enjoy this kind of subgenre of the whodunit. And interestingly, I kind of unconsciously watched See How They Run last week, so it's just come on to Disney Plus. And I didn't really think about the fact that I'd be watching this and then Glass Onion within a week of each other. I'm kind of glad that I did for that kind of point of comparison. I think, you know, with something like See How They Run, it feels a bit stuck within its, because it's kind of based around the Agatha Christie, it feels a bit stuck within its own narrative convention. Whereas this, as you've kind of alluded to, I feel like Rian Johnson's ripped up the rule book and written his own, and that's what really works about it. And I think it gives you those genuinely unexpected twists and turns and surprises, and you can see that he gets so much delight out of that directorial kind of the magician reveal, and I think it just makes it such a delight to watch. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed this. I think I was smiling like a Cheshire cat the whole way through. I was just like, this is so much fun. And it is. And it's just, you're right, it's so much bigger and brighter, and with everything, the characters, the plot, the setting, he's really kind of taken this up a level. And it's just a pure delight, really.
One of the things that really struck me is they kind of keep referencing Clue, where it's kind of like you have everybody who's got their own distinct colour, but like the costuming of this is so much. They do so kind of, you know, it's very excessive a lot of the time. I loved what Leslie Odom was wearing. Obviously, Kate Hudson, as her kind of fashionista, was, you know, decked out in some of the most beautiful stuff I've seen in a long time. But like, do you think that costuming really like added to the plot rather than distracted?
Well, I actually spoke to Rian Johnson for the magazine for this, and we kind of touched a little bit on the costuming, specifically Daniel Craig and his whole getup, which actually he had kind of worked with the costume designer directly to kind of come up with something that was somewhere between Cary Grant and Jacques Tati's kind of Monsieur Hulot doppelganger. And I think that the combination just works so well. And there's also that thing where you go in, obviously, I don't think it's possible to watch a Daniel Craig film now without that thought of him being 007 in the back of your head. So the second he appears on screen, even though he's wearing this kind of, it's maybe not the sort of thing James Bond would wear. It's kind of very much Benoit Blanc on holiday on a kind of Greek island. But it's just such a brilliant costume, and it fits the character. And there's just some really nice touches. Like, there's a swimming pool at the resort, and everyone kind of goes there straight away and just sort of relaxes, and they have their welcome drinks. And Benoit Blanc gets in the pool, but he keeps his shirt on. And I just love that little detail. I think we cut this out of the interview. Ryan Johnson sort of said something like, well, Benoit Blanc's never going to kind of show his nipples. You know, he's there for like business, but equally he's there for pleasure. So I think there's some really clever kind of costume work going on here. And as you say, the rest of the crew as well, equally so. I think Kate Hudson's as the kind of fashionista, her outfits are very fun. Dave Bautista, does he have like a shirt on most of this film? I think maybe not. That's kind of his
MO. He's mostly just got a Speedo and a gun.
Yeah, very apropos. You know, you can tell they've really thought about every kind of little aspect and detail of this. And I think just to kind of add to what Karis was saying before, it is one of those films where you're not necessarily watching it thinking too much about the whodunit. You're thinking just like, oh, this is a really fun ride, and I'm along for it no matter what direction it goes in. And yeah, you're just kind of, it's a real thrill, I think, to watch a film where you just know you're in a safe pair of hands.
Karis, this is a film about such like excessive wealth. What did you think of the design of the private island itself?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're completely right. I think the social satire that is taking a hit at that absurd wealth. I love the bit just before they hop on the yacht when they're kind of COVID concerned and they just kind of basically zap it away. I think it's so funny. But yeah, I love the glass onion being this very kind of big symbol that's kind of constantly there. And it's really where a lot of the big drama takes place. And, you know, Helms is the kind of centre of the island. And just the kind of vastness of it really, I think, is and how kind of separate everyone is in terms of kind of having what they believe is their own privacy, but actually they're kind of constantly being watched by each other, I think is again very funny. You know, it's totally excessive and ridiculous, and that's kind of the point of it, really. Yeah, I love it being set on this island. It feels very, it gave me very Succession vibes, the moment of them kind of arriving on this massive yacht and that the kind of the electronic tech donkey, is it, that like takes all of their luggage. It's just those small little moments that are very funny, that could just, you know, they're almost throwaway, but they're great. Yeah,
it is always, I think, a challenge to make kind of something that is hyper luxurious also really ugly.
Very
a lot
ugly
of the time. Like, I mean, they're able to kind of communicate that Miles Braun has access to everything in the world, but also has horrendous taste when it comes to many of the rooms that they're in. Now we're moving from the kind of cinematic release, you know, this is now a Netflix property. They're going to make several more of these. Like, Adam, do you think that's a good thing that this has moved onto streaming, and like that also we're getting a franchise rather than just, you know, one or two films?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a shame. I think the film is being released in cinemas this week, but only for like a week or so. So do rush out and see it if you can at your local. But Knives Out was obviously very successful. I think relatively modest budget, made a lot of money. This one is a kind of step up in terms of the production budget. And Netflix have pretty deep coffers and seem to be able to fund this sort of stuff. And I think, you know, I think it's no bad thing that Netflix are giving Ryan Johnson a bit more budget and a bit more kind of freedom to continue this story. And it's, you know, it's allowing him to go off and make other stuff. He's doing this TV series with Natasha Lyon with a rival streaming platform, which looks quite fun. And then Daniel Craig has already signed on to come back for a third Knives Out film. Ryan Johnson is in very, very early stages of kind of planning that. So probably be a couple of years before we see that. But you can imagine that will be in a whole completely different locale and different story and characters. So it's just really fun, I think, just seeing a director really at the top of his game. And if you followed Ryan Johnson's career, going from like Brick and Looper and even Brothers Bloom, I think there's like an element of that film in here, and certainly was in Knives Out. And it just feels like these films kind of feel like the apotheosis of everything he's done so far in his career. It's like really built up to this. And not to say that he's kind of peaked, but I think this is like he's kind of firing on all cylinders here, I'd say.
Oh yeah, I couldn't agree more. Karis, for you, were you left excited for where another Knives Out film could go?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I know that he's already kind of spoken about the fact that he's maybe not concerned with having to step up another level. Because I think, as Adam has said, this does feel very much like, not the pinnacle, but, you know, he's kind of marrying all of his previous film's expertise together to create something that is so extravagant and fun and great. But I definitely would like to see more of this and see where this mystery can take Benoit next. And I think Daniel Craig, it is really nice to see. We have become so used to seeing him as Bond and taking himself so seriously on screen, and I think it's really nice to see him in this role that he inhabits so well, and that perfect like southern lilt that, and the cadence of that just lends itself to the comedy, and I think he does it so well, and it's just very fun. So yeah, I'm definitely excited to see what's next and how he can.
It's not just Daniel Craig who's giving a fantastic performance in this film. There's an incredible ensemble, and I had the absolutely delightful experience of talking about Glass Onion with Catherine Hahn and Kate Hudson. Hope you enjoy listening as much as I did.
So lovely to meet you.
Hi, sorry. Such a pleasure meeting you. Oh,
it's an Hi. Absolute delight. I love this movie.
Oh, so much of your characters are expressed through what they're wearing.
Yes.
Like, you know, so incredibly glamorous and heightened, and they're like much more utilitarian, but
it's very
like,
kind.
I'm wondering, on set, were you ever kind of jealous and wish that you were in like the other person's?
Were you? Let me bring this to Kate. Were you ever jealous of my beige sheath and Taylor Long dress,
only
which I loved?
Your orange tanning visor, darling. That was the only thing I was so
what
jealous
about my spa
of.
Robe?
Of course. No, you know what? I was... Look, I definitely yes. wasn't jealous of your outfits.
Sure, okay, we're going
to be
gonna,
honest.
I don't want you okay. to not be honest.
I might have been jealous, funny enough...
The comfort.
Of Edward. Because he had, like... those loose pants, like he's actually wearing mm-hmm. what I would actually yeah. wear more of, like a mix between Whiskey and Edward.
Yes,
that
yes.
would have been my
yes
personal
yeah
Greek
yeah.
island style.
Yeah,
so there were times when I'm in all of these clothes that are fabulous,
yes.
but like after a couple of days, I'm like, I just want to be
yes.
in Whiskey's bikini
and like some
Edward's
gauzy pants. Yeah.
I mean, the first one, we kind of had that white cable knit sweater that
yes.
went viral. Did you think that there was kind of maybe an item of clothing that might do something similar in this one?
Oh, I think Blanc's bathing.
Swimming.
Ensemble.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, his swimsuit.
Yeah,
I mean, that swimsuit's pretty great.
How can you...
With the little cravat.
Right.
It's pretty yeah. fabulous. It looks a little bit... I don't want to jinx anything by saying iconic, but there's something pretty iconic about it. To me.
Yeah, it's a very underrated accessory, a tiny, tiny neck scarf.
It's unexplored.
And you know what's interesting? Lately, I've
yeah.
been noticing them on so many people.
The littlest ones?
Yes, the little wrapped neck scarf is like, I saw it on this photographer I worked with the other day. I was like, oh, it's a Benoit Blanc. You know,
special.
Yeah.
Because you're right, it's not like a cravat.
One of the
it's just like a no. tight little, yeah. I haven't really seen it that often.
It's because it has no function, I think,
yeah.
that makes it so exciting.
Yeah.
Exciting.
It's so pointless.
Right. Right.
But you guys first worked together on How to Lose a Guy in 10
I
Days.
Know, my first movie.
But I was just thinking, like, we've recently been talking a lot in film journalism at least, about how much we missed, like, really, like, loads of rom-coms and kind of how we wish
Classic.
That would come back. Is that something that you guys really want to see have a revival?
I mean, I have a whole theory about this, which is that the great romantic comedies are always an uphill battle, like mm-hmm. every movie. Because there's something that happens
yeah.
with rom-coms. They want to put it in a box. They want to make it super bright. They don't ever want to take chances doing anything different.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so you have to approach them. It takes a very specific type of director and a writer and a producer and the actors
yes.
to know... how to it's really not an easy genre to get right,
mm-hmm.
and when you do get it right, they're going to be some of the most classic movies really of all time that people watch over and over and over and over again. So it's a very specific ability, like the murder mystery. When you can hit a rom-com in the right way, it's great. And then but if it's, you know, if I think that after a while, there's this sort of a dumbing down of them because it becomes the movie that you just want to make because you think people want to just... It's why I stopped making them
mm-hmm.
as often, you know. I don't think I'll ever make them anymore unless I'm actually producing them, because I don't, I think that they're really hard, and you really have to fight for things with them internally.
That's so interesting. I never thought of that before, but you're right. There is a certain like aesthetic that people just like can't quite move off of. That you're right. It's like it's like why? Same with studio comedy sometimes. It's like there is like a certain like lighting, like a flattening of something that it's like, why not try something new visually? And yeah, I don't know.
And the casting of,
yes,
it is just everything, you know. And the other thing is it's really hard to get male movie stars,
yes,
to make rom-coms.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so let's just say that. Yeah,
it's not really the things they, you know. There's a couple that are very open to that, but you know, it's really hard to get them to come on board.
But with this, you've kind of got this ensemble, and I imagine the casting is really key. You guys all kind of come from such different backgrounds, and, you know, Leslie with the music and Dave with the wrestling and everything. Like, what do you think was the key to kind of it actually coming together to be a kind of believable group of people that would stay in each other's lives?
I mean, well,
Ryan.
Yeah. I mean, it's Ryan. He just knows. And also, just a sidebar, Dave is an incredible actor, mm-hmm, and has done a bunch after his wrestling career. Like this, I'm so excited for this next chapter for him because he's such a profound actor in person.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ryan, I think, really did cast people as well as these characters because, mm-hmm, he knew how much time we would be spending together. So he really did think what humans are gonna, like, he was, you know, like Kate has said before, like he was hosting. Kind of.
Yeah.
Like, he really
was.
Like,
who do I want around the table?
Who do I want to hang out with and are going to hang out with together for this amount of time? And so, like, he knew what he was doing. And so, everybody was just such delicious humans. And we really do, like, I mean, there's so much love between this little group of ragtag humans, circus people, that we just, there's really a lot of love.
But it must be like an added pressure coming out of the pandemic, a bit like your characters, about like, oh, we're gonna be us together. I gotta make sure I have a good
experience. Though it really did happen naturally because we started in Greece, so it was like everyone had their own beautiful, mm-hmm, places, and we'd have like these kind of mellow meetings, and it started with like smaller scenes, and so like it wasn't like everybody all at once,
right? But by the time we got to Serbia,
yes,
it was like I was, you know, it was like, do you still want to have dinner with me, or is it like
right,
are you sick of me yet, do you want to?
And then we just kept going, and it was like, tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter. By the end, it was like 6 to 8 weeks, and on Saturday nights, we just all would just hang out. Mm-hmm. It was the best.
I think also we had, you know, there was enough of us to where we would go to, you know, we would have our own little moments too,
yes,
you know, where you and I would go do something, and Janelle and I would go do something, you and Janelle, like, there was sort of a... It was very fluid.
Yeah.
I think the kind of thing that's almost so impressive about this is that these are not the greatest of people. They're morally dubious.
Yes.
But, like, how do you then approach kind of... You don't want people to kind of hate spending time with them on screen, but you want them to kind of love to hate them. Like, how do you kind of strike that balance?
That's all in the script.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I don't know how it is for you, Kate, but I never want to put, like, any sort of stress of my own on top of like, is anybody gonna like or dislike this person? I just have to play the play and trust Ryan that he will take care of the outcome. Like, you know, that's when you sign on to something. That's where you're putting your faith and your performance into Ryan's writing and into his direction, into the editor,
and the choices
mm-hmm,
casting too.
Yeah.
You know, but I think also at the end of the day, it really is what makes a great filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to walk the line is a really, like, you have to be very skilled and intelligent and talented to be able to execute that, and those usually make the most fun movies, you know. Yeah, to love the enemy is like a really interesting thing to make people like, you know?
Yeah.
it does kind of seem to almost be like a bit of a weird parallel with Miles Braun, in that you guys like put yourselves in the hand of kind of someone that was going to direct it, and like
no Miles
maybe,
Braun.
You know, you're on an island kind of at the mercy of someone, and you just, you know, maybe it's a Miles Braun, maybe it's a Rian Johnson.
Yeah, but there's so many differences, but the main one is that these people ethically compromised need him, and for so many complicated reasons. Rian is such a decent, kind, like such a generous person, and he really was, like, and also just the environment that we had freedom wise just to explore, and it just felt, especially with something that was so perfectly, so well crafted as a script, there never was a feeling of like tightness on set. And I don't know how he pulled it off, really, because there wasn't a ton of improvising, but it just felt continuously loose, and that was really such a gift. Yeah.
I mean, you're kind of straddling the kind of Hollywood tech world in a way, because obviously Fabletics has just done incredible stuff with like e-commerce. I'm just wondering, have you come across that sort of Miles Braun hedonistic tech bro in your time?
Oh, they're everywhere. But they're in every walk of any business and all of our lives. I mean, you know, you're going to have... Yeah. I think in the business, on the business side of thing, it's one of those... It's grow, build. You know, that's kind of what's happening. And it's also interesting in the business world to see people kind of, after COVID, start to ask, what is the purpose?
Yeah.
Why are you doing this? And some people are asking that question, and some people just aren't. You know, and which is destructive.
Yeah.
But in everything, you know, you have that, and you have every walk of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Rian really does kind of paint that picture out well in this movie.
I mean, there were a couple of kind of real life people that I thought of when I was kind of watching your characters that might be references, but were there people kind of fictional or in real life that you were drawing on in preparation for these?
Not for me.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
There's so many.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That it's like, that I didn't need to go any, that what he had written, it was already on. All I really needed was on the, as an actor, it's all about the script.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go outside of it, then that's not what you need. But so it's all in the script. But for sure, I mean, we're living in the world we're living in, but all you need as an actor is right in front of you.
Unless it is a specific thing, you know. I mean, he created all these really fun new characters out of this, you know, crazy time we're living in. And it's supposed to be fun, right? So you want to make them...
It's
fun,
so
full of insanity.
So, I mean, speaking of fun, there is a point that your character Catherine cannot help but imitate Daniel Craig's accent. Is that tempting? Because like I almost watching it was like I need to go to the bathroom and like try this voice.
That was actually a little bit improvised.
Oh, great.
Then I couldn't believe that Rian kept it in, but I couldn't help it. Had to try it.
Did you do the thing in Toronto where we had to do our best Benoit Blanc?
No, I did not do that.
They made us, me and Leslie, do our best Benoit Blanc.
That is amazing.
And Leslie's was so
good.
Oh,
I bet it was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he nailed it, but it was fun.
They asked, someone on the red carpet last night asked me to say something in the Benoit Blanc accent, and I could not hear anything but his beautiful English accent, and so I just did it in an English accent. Because I just kept hearing it. I was like, enjoy the film! And I was like, wait a minute, let me do it again.
Yeah, it's not one that you hear much outside of like Foghorn Leghorn and
that's
Benoit
what he
Blanc.
Was saying. Yes, yes.
You spoke a lot about the writing, but I mean, what was the experience of like first getting the script? Was it like a case of like you're tearing through, trying to find out the twist, trying to figure out what happens?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was definitely like as I kept going through it, I was like, how is he going to pull this off? How is he going to pull this off? Like, I couldn't believe how many things he was setting up. And I just, as I kept reading it, I couldn't believe that they were all paying off. Like, that thrill was so, I just felt, especially after being such a fan of the original Knives Out, I was so excited that it was, I couldn't believe that he pulled it off again. Yeah, it was very exciting as a read. And then to be able to see it at TIFF for the first time with an audience, like we all got to see it together, except I think for Daniel had seen it, but that was so satisfying to see it land on screen with the same kind of awe and wonder that I had reading it. It was really delightful.
I think not only has he pulled it off again, I think it's better, honestly. I think this is just it's a rare sequel that surpasses the original.
Amazing.
But for you, what were the elements for the original Knives Out that you were, like, most hoping to see again in this sequel?
For me, I think it would the sense of ensemble, the buoyancy of the ensemble, the specificity of the ensemble. I know the kind of, not that anyone's referencing Clue, but like the Clue card of everybody, the like of the characters was so fun of the original. And also the location as a character itself of the original was really fun. And that sharp editing and that music, I was very excited.
And I mean, it just works so well as kind of cutting political satire as well.
Yes.
Like, was that kind of important to you, that kind of message got across about, like, you know, talking about, I guess, societal disease, and this is like a manifestation of it?
Ryan said this one time in a Q&A or something we were doing, where it's like, I think it's really important to leave that up to the audience of how, what they take from it, you know, that we kind of, he presented them with this really fun roller coaster ride, as he says, and whatever anyone wants to take from it, they can, and whatever dialogue that creates, instead of feeding it anything like that to anyone, that they should just experience it themselves and think about what maybe comes out of it for them, because it's going to be a little bit different for everyone, I think. You know, I think everybody will get like a little, you know, it'll bring up different things.
Like, go on, first and foremost, it's a ride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to go into anything, especially beforehand, would be, you don't want to, everyone should just go in with an, like, completely not knowing, like, knowing as little as possible. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully talk after.
So I have not asked you about any specific.
You've been amazing. You are amazing.
Well, it's so hard to do.
It's so hard to do.
I just want everybody to have like the pure joy that
I
have.
I am so glad. So oh, really?
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
So we should finally get some scores on this. Adam, do you want to go in first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Sure. I think probably like a 4. I mean, I love Knives Out. I think there's always that that slight concern of it not being as good as the thing you love. So I'd say a 4. Definitely a 5 in enjoyment. I think it's just a very fun film, and just so well written. So many fun performances in there. And maybe a 4 in retrospect. I think I would say that Ryan probably would challenge himself to top this one with the next one. So I think there's probably even more to come, excitingly.
Karis, what about you?
I think I was a 4 in anticipation, definitely a 5 in enjoyment, and I think I would also be a 4 in retrospect, actually.
Oh, I love how synced up we are. I am also 4, 5, 4. I'm so kind of thrilled for all the kind of cancellations or kind of things that don't get made by Netflix. I'm just going to be the most staunch defender, and I will be on that platform until the apocalypse, because they give filmmakers like Rian Johnson the opportunity to make just great movies like this that I cannot wait to watch again. Next up, Film Club. Set in the neurosurgical ward of a Copenhagen hospital, each episode of The Kingdom takes place over a single day and follows the hospital staff and patients as they encounter bizarre and sometimes supernatural phenomena. Yeah, so Adam, that is a summary of what it is, but I'd say that Lars von Trier's show is so much more than that. I mean, how would you describe it?
Oh my goodness. I mean, it's kind of a combination of so many different things. It's a kind of hospital set sitcom on one level. It's like a supernatural thriller on another level. It's a ghost story. It's a very kind of hard thing to actually define and describe, I think, unless you've kind of watched it previously. And so we should say that we decided to go off piste a little bit with this choice of Film Club, because eagle-eared listeners, if that's the thing, will notice this is not a film, but a series. I'm not sure we've ever done a series before in this segment, but anyway. But we're very excited about The Kingdom Exodus, which is the sort of continuation continuation slash revival of the series from the kind of mid-90s, which is coming out later this month. In fact, I think it's coming out later this week on Mubi and running all the way through to Christmas with episodes dropping weekly. So nice little early Christmas present from Uncle Lars. We thought we'd revisit the kind of original series from the kind of mid-90s, just as a kind of way to tease the new series. And yeah, it's really fun. I mean, I must say, as much as I'm a fan of Lars von Trier, I hadn't actually seen this before. I don't think it's been that widely available, certainly not in the UK. And so, yeah, it was a real treat. So the first two series seasons are on Mubi now. So if you have Mubi already, definitely kind of check those out. And it's a kind of an interesting, comes at an interesting time in Lars's career, if you look back, because it was kind of the pre-Dogma, before he sort of reinvented himself, and while he was still making, I guess films with a bit more of a kind of satirical edge to them, a bit more mischievous. It's more like the Lars we sort of know and love today. But it's off the back of it having this amazing run in the kind of late 80s and early 90s, which culminated in like Europa, which I think is still one of his best films, which famously won a lot of awards at Cannes, but didn't win the big one, and he was quite peeved about. And I think he was feeling a bit burnt out at the time from these more kind of artistic pursuits, and shifted towards television, and he'd set up his production company, Zentropa, at the time, and kind of saw The Kingdom as a way to make a bit of money and you know, do something which was maybe playing to a kind of wider gallery. And it's an interesting one, because actually this, I think, has got a huge amount of artistic merit to it, as well as being almost like satirizing or lampooning, you know, hospital set sitcoms and a certain style of like TV comedy. I think he pitched it originally as like his answer or his version to like Twin Peaks. There's maybe not too many comparisons. I think certainly in some of the performances and the characterization, there's a certain like uncanniness and a bit of a kind of off-kilter vibe to it. But I think what he's doing is quite different actually to David Lynch. And it's very much Lars's own thing.
Yeah, I mean, I can see the parallels in that sort of like nightmare logic that kind of runs through them, where, I mean, as much as this is quite surreal, there is a sort of dream level on which you are able to kind of engage with it, if that makes sense. And it does sort of cumulatively add up. Karis, is this the first time for you also coming to The Kingdom?
It is, yeah.
Odd. And but were you a fan of Lars von Trier's before? Did you have like expectations as to what you were kind of getting in?
Yes, kind of. I haven't gone through his entire back catalogue. I think the last thing that I watched of his was maybe The House That Jack Built, which was obviously, I remember it in Cannes and it being so controversial. So yeah, it's interesting now to kind of revisit this. But yeah, I enjoyed it more than I thought. I did think it was a bit of a slow burn, but I was definitely hooked, and I can definitely see how this particular project has, I can see its influences, I can see the Twin Peaks influence, and I can also see how it has then influenced other projects. I know that kind of docu-series, kind of the shaky cam footage, and how that's influenced things, even like The Office. And yeah, I found it very, very interesting and fascinating to watch. It's the performances I thought were great, and it had me hooked.
Yeah, I found myself on a bit of a deep dive, discovering that there was an American remake of this that was kind of headed up by Stephen King. And it's one of those things where the American remake entirely misses the point of the original. Because I think what's so key to like Lars von Trier, this one in particular, but a lot of his work, is that like, is the humor. And the humor just did not translate to the American edition. So for those kind of who want to avoid subtitles, don't do it. Watch the original.
It's quite specific as well, some of the humour, because you've got like one of the main antagonists, really, but there's a Swedish neurosurgeon who very kind of irascible, and he's sort of like famously, you know, comes to this Copenhagen hospital, but he basically doesn't like Danish people and lets them know it. And I think there's, you know, there's those tensions there. There's the kind of, I guess, more like local level, but like geopolitical tensions and little kind of observed humour that I think works really well. And Lars is definitely playing more to that audience than like a more general audience. But it totally works on that level. And I think you watch it now and there's nothing really that you watch it and you think, oh, this feels really, aside from like the way it's made, I don't think you would say, oh, this feels really dated or very like of its time. Kind of in the same way, actually, going back to Twin Peaks, I think that has a similar thing where it could kind of be made today, I think. it's got that kind of quality to it. It's not that it's specifically referencing something which happened at a certain point in time, although obviously what it's pastiching is like you say, these kind of like Stephen King cheap serial kind of TV sitcoms and horror series that were being kind of churned out at the time. It's just very clever. It kind of is a bit of a slow burn. I see what you mean by that. It's, I mean, the first couple of episodes just kind of mostly play out as a sort of situation, like workplace comedy, or more kind of drama, really, I suppose. And then it has these like little kind of flashes of, you know, the supernatural, and one of the characters is a sort of amateur like spiritual medium, and there's this kind of running gag really where she's coming up with feigning illness just to kind of check herself back into the hospital to sort of pursue this kind of ghostly figure of a child that she hears in the elevator, and there's just some really nice playful dynamics as well between some of the characters, and you know, I think the way it observes hospital life is quite funny. Also must say, big shout out to Lars himself, the very funny little sign-offs he does at the end of each episode. He kind of comes on, you know, mid credits and sort of says, oh, thanks for watching, and almost like dangles this carrot of like, maybe you didn't quite get this, but that's okay. And it's very funny, like seeing him, much younger, more kind of vigorous version of himself, but coming on and doing that, almost that thing of provoking the audience, which he's obviously become so well known for now.
And Karis, you know, Lars von Trier has spoken recently about how he's really not in very good health at all, and you know, we wish the best for him. But do you think it's surprising that, given like you sort of the end, hopefully not too close to, but you know, coming towards the end of your life, and that this is the kind of project that he would return to?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think it is kind of fascinating. I suppose there's a nice kind of cyclical element to it, and it is something that has such a kind of cult following that it's almost kind of maybe more fan servicey than anything else that he's decided to kind of revisit this.
But it is interesting because I think he was, you know, the first two series were quite well received, and I think he did want to make a third season like back in the 90s, and two of the lead actors actually had died kind of in between, you know, after the second series, so he, you know, put that on pause. And I mean, there's this one, I think, because of the obscurity really of those original seasons, this one isn't really strictly like a third season. It is very much like it's him revisiting the same kind of scenario and the same ideas, but it's an updated thing. It's a continuation of the same kind of certain elements of it, but it's him revisiting it now. It's very interesting to see with The Kingdom Exodus, like what his kind of preoccupations and concerns are, really, I suppose, and whether there is more, I suppose, more of him in there, in that sense of like returning to this setting, this hospital setting, you know, given everything that's going on with him now. It does feel like there is a slightly more poignancy to it. It's definitely taken on more of a kind of personal tone, I'd say.
Well, best of luck to Mr. von Trier. He's made a few slip-ups in his time, but you know, certainly net positive from my perspective. If you've got thoughts on these films, email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, Noah Baumbach directs another Marriage Story, albeit an unpredictable one, in White Noise. A documentary looks at David Lynch's fascination with The Wizard of Oz. And finally on Film Club, it's For My Money, the greatest Christmas film ever made, A Muppet's Christmas Carol. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Layla Latif, and my guests this week were Adam Woodward and Karis Aldridge. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.